They're as deep as six. He had picked up his bottle of scotch from the floor and poured some into his glass on the upholstered arm of his chair, motioned for me to hold out my glass, and filled it to where I told him thanks. I did some work around San Francisco then, and did not expect I'd ever see him again, but probably would read about his death in the paper. It was likely. The nation was nasty about unions and tramps, immigrants and Jews. Still is. I read in the paper then early in 1914 about his arrest in Utah, and would not have been surprised except that it reported that he had been found guilty of murder. And that I could not believe. The paper said that late in the night of January 10, John G. Morrison and his son, Arling, were killed in their Salt Lake City butcher shop by two armed intruders masked in red bandanas. The two had shot his father before Arling had been able to draw out a handgun from underneath the counter and wounded one of the masked men after being shot himself. Both men died within minutes. His youngest son, Merlin, 13, had come down the stairs from where the family lived above the store and had witnessed the whole thing. He reported the two men had come out bursting in the door, holding pistols out in front of themselves, shouting, "We've got you now," and fired, killing his father, and ran off just as his brother got off a shot. His brother died in his arms. The police first thought it must be a crime of revenge, for nothing had been stolen. Morrison was a former policeman who had lived in constant dread of those he had previously arrested. Twice before, Morrison had shot up men who had attacked him. Police found Morrison's pistol discharged. A witness out in the street reported seeing two men run from the store, one holding his hands to his chest. On the same evening, Joe appeared in the doorstep of a local doctor, bearing a bullet wound. Joe told the doc that he had been shot in an argument over a woman, whom he refused to name. The doctor said that he had a pistol. The paper reported that Joe was an itinerant worker who moved around the West, hopping freight trains, going from job to job, that he had been working at the Silver King Mine outside of Salt Lake City. 12 people were arrested in the case before Joe was arrested and charged with murder. A red bandana was found in his pocket. The pistol purported to be in his possession at the doctor's office was not found. Joe denied he was involved in the robbery and the killing. He did not testify at his trial. His lawyers pointed out that four other people were treated for bullet wounds in Salt Lake City that same night, and that he and the victim did not know each other. And so, with no robbery, he had no motive to kill the man and his son. The newspapers brought out the fact of his political sympathies. There was lurid coverage about him as a famous labor agitator, a wobbly and a communist. For reasons not explained in the paper, the U.S. Justice Department from Washington stepped in. The young, able Assistant Attorney General for seditious crimes, no less, was brought in at the request of the governor to act as public prosecutor. The prosecution produced a couple dozen witnesses on his seditious activities, and a dozen or so eyewitnesses who said that the killer resembled him, including 13-year-old Merlin Morrison, the victim's son and brother, who said at first, "That's not him at all," but later changed his mind on the stand, after everyone else seemed certain that it was. The jury took just a few hours to find him guilty. The judge issued sentence of execution immediately, over objections of the defense, whose motions to appeal were summarily dismissed. He was scheduled to die in 7 days. I sent a wire to our operative as I boarded the train to Salt Lake and took up my station in the club car to sleep and drink my way across the California country. In 10.5 hours, with 2 transfers, I was stepping out into a dry, bleaching morning light within a dead-aim eye shot of the Angel Moroni, poised on the prick of a pointy spire of the shiny white temple of the Latter-day Saints. I had a highball in my hand, which he could plainly see, and it was the last legal liquor that I should have until I left this hellish place. The air smelled like brimstone, and hot salt, in fact. It made the nostrils sore, and you know, I don't think I saw a single green plant or tree in the place the whole time I was there. I gave my empty glass back to the porter who handed me my traveling bag when our operative took up my other hand to shake, saying that he had set me up to meet right away with the police detective that would be some help to us, though he had not been personally involved in the case. That he was not involved, I doubted at first, since this was such a splashy case for a small pond. But I would learn that, in fact, this pious modern city had several impious modern murders every week, and that the constabulary put away more vagrants in a day than we did in San Francisco in a month, being intolerant of filth and persons whose dark skin came by causes other than God-given sunburn. But it may be that the searing sunlight here made the bad stand out more sharply, where they stood among the good. Certainly it was true you could tell the God-fearing natives by a certain look in their eyes, like mirrors where minds ought to be. The detective met us at the courthouse. It was not the usual hard heart I was used to, but more like a soldier. A soldier of Christ was my guess. And he presumed my good intentions because I was a Pinkerton, and we always stood with the bosses. He unlocked the evidence room, and I pawed through the catalog boxes under his helpful supervision, and I found there what I had expected. Meanwhile, my operative, having been sent by me to inquire for it, using again the cachet of the imprimatur of my calling card and my impressive title, came back and said we had got an immediate appointment to see the judge in the case, the U.S. Attorney General from Washington, who was abiding the execution, I imagined, and his personal federal marshal. The judge did not get up when I came in. The U.S. attorney did, but he was just a kid. I was, too, but I could carry off a kind of faux decay about me that suggested my real age was disguised by the preserving agency of untold years of immoral abuses. The short, young federal marshal leaned against the wall of legal books behind the judge, his arms folded. The U.S. attorney gave me his name. That was the first time I met Jonathan. I told him without preamble that I did not believe that Joe had killed these men, and I had come to prove it. That I had looked at the evidence, and had found the coat that he had worn that night that he had been shot, and that this evidence alone exonerated him of the crime. They did not blink or bear any verbal witness to my remarks, but the judge looked wrathfully disturbed, and the young federal marshal smirked. Then Jonathan, who, God bless him, seemed genuinely curious and concerned, asked me to explain myself. I had the coat with me. I held it up and showed them what I meant, putting my finger through the bullet hole in the back of it. "Joe was shot in the back," I said. "Not in the chest, as the Morrison boy had said. And, too, the wound he had was high on his back. Did not pass far into flesh, glancing off his left scapula from what I guessed was a bad shot, maybe misfired. But, you see, this bullet hole is low on the back side of the coat. Joe had been turned away from the man who shot him, and he had his hands raised above his head, defenseless. If anything, the man who shot Joe was intending to murder him rather than the other way around. The judge scowled at my calling card in front of him on his desk, leaned over, and buzzed for his secretary through an intercom, and when she came in, he dictated a wire to go to Pinkerton himself, demanding to know why he was interfering in this case. He told me that I was not welcome to investigate further, and he did not know why I should be investigating the matter in the first place. The federal marshal grinned and put his hands into trouser pockets. Jonathan looked anxiously at the judge. My operative apologized for the both of us and pulled on my sleeve to get me out of the room. When we got out to the hall, walking away, he warned me under his breath that the judge's brother was a U.S. senator, and that this was not going to go well, and that he sure hoped I knew what I was doing. I said I did not want to see an innocent man executed. I sent a wire back to the home office when I got to my hotel and went to bed. Later, from the hotel room, I called the operative and dismissed him, saying I would rest up and be leaving soon for San Francisco, and thanked him for his help. He was a lightweight and did not want him to get involved, and he did not need to get hurt by association with what I had to do. What had made no sense about Joe's visit to the doctor was that he had not gone to the doc who sympathized with the Wobblies. Four others arrested out of suspicion had been treated for bullet wounds that night, and one of these had a wound to the chest and had been treated by a doc whom I was willing to bet was a Pinko. I had that name from the file. When I woke and went down to the lobby, it was too late for breakfast, I was told. Apparently even meals must obey moral rules in Salt Lake. Bad enough you could not drink, but why you couldn't get breakfast at noon? I rang the doc, and he did not want me to come to his office, but said we would meet out of town if I could rent a car. Renting a car was something I could not do, it turned out, there being not many cars in that town at that time, so I went to see a man about a horse. The doc was overdressed for the heat of the day, I thought. He was thin, wore thick-lens spectacles, nervous as a clumsy bomb maker, and looked cold in his sweat in this stuffy, shifty barroom he'd sent me to. There was this nowhere non-Mormon community outside of Salt Lake, not large, but it had this illicit place that illegally served liquor on the salty edge of a blue water lake. A landscape in precious white and gleaming blue, like a some kiln-fired Dutch Delft. The place thrived, was not shut down by the Mormons as it was beyond the city limits, and so he explained, quite a few Mormons themselves frequented as well. Not the first time and not the last that I saw stinky old sin break out when it's been pent up. He swigged his scotch and added, even a priest farts in church. He lit another cigarette before he resumed. In the silence, I heard the rain on the windows like a hissing, and looked and saw it streaking on the glass. What he told me sent me to the mine where Joe had worked, and it getting to be late in the day and my horse none too hurried, I did not get there until after dark, and came up on what I took to be a site for tramps, and asked around, meeting a few fellows I knew from the time at Wenatchee. I told them a story that they believed, and found where Joe's disciples were camped, and went to there. Coming up on the camp, I saw a nest of canvas tents facing campfire. Actually, there were several in coves of hills, which surrounded the silver mine. On the ridges of them was a high-fenced web of barbed wire, like a federal prison has, with guard posts and men at machine guns at intervals, for the owners were constantly in fear that they would have their silver stolen. They made the men strip and go naked from the mine each every workday, and wear different clothes inside and outside the mine so they might not secret out any ore. You might not tell one camp from the next, except that I recognized some of the men, and there was a red flag strapped on one tent pole to give it some elevation. It hung in no wind. I only knew that it was by previous encounter, it being almost dark by the time I got there. And though dark, as I say, I recognized most of the men. I cannot say that they were glad to see me as much as surprised. How I was dressed surprised them, made them wary. But I explained I was there to see if I might get Joe off, that I did not believe he was guilty. Even this did not make them more friendly, and there was one in particular who had been with Joe since the days of Duluth, since the beginning, yet he pretended not to know who I was talking about. I was going to give up on this, looking for something, anything that might help me, because I thought it likely that someone here knew either who the real killers were or where Joe had been that night, when I got a jolt. He came out of the darkness, I swear, I thought it Joe himself. I was going to even use his name for him, but then some others said, having seen the look on my face, no, that there is Tom. I could not say what I thought, but I asked if he knew anything that might help me, and he said he did not know that maybe Joe had done it. I slept in Joe's roll. When the cock crowed, I left his friends who began to shuffle off to the mine. Back in the hotel, the dossier I had wired for had arrived in a string-tied bundle, sent over from the train station. I cut it open on my bed in my room, and found some field notes written by my own hand, some by others. Some typed pages, too, chronologically arranged. The local operator in Salt Lake, the previous one to the boy that is there now, he'd picked up a name for the woman that Joe might have been visiting. It was about 2 years ago that this had started, just after he and the others first tramped here out of Wenatchee. I hated that horse, and I think he hated me back. He knew where I wanted to go and was inclined to stop if I listed in the saddle, and balked stubbornly rather than have to plod across that sagebrush plain and salt flats, where we could see the faraway mine camp simmering in mirage out of the heat, looking closer than it was. And it was, again, not until twilight that I got to the camp, and he picked up the pace to get to the water. They had just come out of the mine, some of them walking mostly naked from the gate to their camp, where they poured water over themselves, which my horse sucked up. I told them the name I knew. It was at last the one who had denied knowing Joe admitted to her identity, reluctantly. He told me she had gotten married, that she'd had a boy child and lived in Salt Lake. No one else spoke about it. Something terrible had now been done, it seemed to them. It was like this act which might save Joe was the act that certainly meant his death. I was slow on the uptake, always have been. My shortcoming as a detective. I went back across the plain through the night, and the horse seemed just as glad that I did, for it was much cooler. And though I could not see where I was going, except for the general gleam of the city lights ahead, the horse knew well what he was doing, being guided by his own intention to eat and drink and nestle down in his own stable. He fairly galloped once we struck a city street. I got to my hotel a lot sooner than I expected and got to bed and slept without even a whiskey. I was so tired myself. The next day, got up early enough to get a breakfast in Salt Lake, bathed, put on my only respectable clean suit, sent what I had worn out onto the salt flats to the Chinamen, hoping that they could get out the alkaline stains, and went to find the woman. If she loved him, she would help me, or by God, I'd expose her anyway. At the courthouse, in the Department of Deeds and Records, I found what I was looking for. I was going to leave then, take a cab to the address, and speak to her. I did not care who it hurt. If anything, now I had a moral and personal vengeance in mind. I relished the justice of my discovery. But in the halls, I encountered the short, young U.S. Marshal sent down to guard the U.S. Attorney General, or for some other reason, perhaps. Even then, however, J. Edgar Hoover did not answer to anyone or anything, but right and wrong as he knew it. He had a two-way radio to righteousness in his own head, and he himself kept under lock and key the original copy of the Book of Names that Jesus will use on the day of the last judgment. Seeing me come out of the records room, he knew what I was up to. He had heard by report, perhaps by that two-way radio in his head, that I was in the building and what I had found. I could tell by looking at him that he himself had known the truth all along. Hoover did not need to speak or gesture. He opened a door in the hallway and went into an empty office and held the door for me. I went in, and he shut the door. It must be a jury room, vacant, awaiting a trial to complete. The light through the windows shot a beam loaded with motes of dust, suspended like golden specks. There was no movement of air in the room. They moved only a little because of the disturbance of our voices. Neither of us sat, but we faced each other across the long juror's table. Could have been the room that gave the verdict against Joe, I thought. Hoover spoke before I did. We have the right man. He knew what I would say, so I did not say it. He went on. Whether he's guilty of this murder, or guilty of another murder, or guilty of something else, or not guilty, we are executing the man we should. I said, suppose she steps forward. He'll kill her. I said, suppose I tell the Attorney General. What makes you think he doesn't know? I understood then how it happened, how it was hopeless. I did not have the heart to go see Joe. I felt I had betrayed him too. Betrayed him by what I had done before, at any rate, and now was going to walk away again. I was guilty with a lot of them, but it was what Joe wanted. Hoover did not seem to gloat over my despair, at least. He said nothing more and left me alone to look at the dust motes mix up in the sunbeam after he went out the door, shutting it behind him, left me to think about it all. I think that is when I made up my mind to quit this detective business. When I was going out the door of the courthouse, standing in the sunlight, the angel Moroni looking down at me from beyond the city's dead grass quadrangle, I saw her myself, neat, nicely dressed, summery clothes befitting the weather, if not the time of year. And then, this was a place that was out of nature, and beyond the time of the rest of the world. She stepped from a horse-drawn, hansom cab, turned to help a child step down, and to take from the floor of the cab a picnic basket. She was bringing her husband his lunch. She looked pale. She looked like one who is already dead. She passed me where I stood. I tipped my hat. She had the eyes of the sorrowful Mother of God. I went back to the hotel and settled my bill, packed my bag, and picked up my suit from the Chinaman on the way to the train. I got on the train. I was down the track and three Scotch highballs deep into a comfortable drunk when it hit me. Hoover was a fucking liar. So, I got off at a whistle stop with a bottle I bought dear from the barman and got a straw-hatted farmer in a Model T to take me back to Salt Lake for $10 cash. I found Jonathan in his hotel room alone. I confronted him without preamble, and he looked genuinely shocked and sick at heart, and grabbed up his hat, and we went together to see Joe in the cells. Joe was actually glad to see me, and I will tell you that I'm not a man for tears or sentimentalities, but the warmth with which he greeted me, well, I just could not help myself, and Joe said it was a good thing I was doing, as if he knew. I shook my head and said to him, "You can't let them do this to you." He had laid his hand over my heart and said, "You know I do." I shook my head. And Jonathan said, "But you are an innocent man. It was the judge that shot you." "You don't understand," Joe replied. Now he put his hand over Jonathan's heart and said, "You don't even know who you are, do you?" There was nothing that either Jonathan or I could say. I accepted it before Jonathan could. He was bitterly angry at Hoover. But Hoover gave back to him as good as he was given, and for his part felt no moral sickness in this thing. Jonathan threatened the judge who wired his brother, the U.S. senator, who called the White House, who sent Jonathan a telegram. Jonathan was supposed to attend the execution but could not bear it. Joe asked me to witness it, and I did, for his sake. The way these things are done in Utah, the firing squad is made up of 5 volunteers from the jailers. They could not find any in Joe's case. They found some willing volunteers from the church, but there was controversy among the elders about their participation. Troubling rumors were damaging the pleasant sensibilities of the community. In the end, 5 jailers were reluctantly recruited with the stipulation that only 3 guns would have real bullets, and that none would know who had the murderous rounds, so that by the blessing of doubt, one might believe he was not the one who killed him. Even so, when the time came for the command to fire, no one did, until Joe himself said, "Fire." Every one of us wept. In his last will and testament, Joe left his body and possessions. His guitar was all he really owned in the world. Left it all to Jonathan. Acting on his instructions, Joe's body was cremated and his ashes were boxed up and shipped off to the IWW headquarters in Chicago to be distributed to all the lodges across the U.S. for a ceremony. But the IWW never got the box because it was intercepted by the U.S. Postal Service and quarantined as containing subversive material. As far as I know, they still have his ashes in some warehouse somewhere. Mr. Hammett put out his cigarette and, raising his bottle of scotch, perceived with a shake that only a little less than a glassful rustled inside of it. So he shared it with me. We drank it neat in a last toast. He lit a cigarette and, making to get up, said to sum up, "Jonathan and I both quit our jobs then, sent fuck you telegrams to our employers from Salt Lake. We went on the bum for a time. Later on, we joined the army together. I got sick. He went over. There's more. There's always more. But that is the story of how we met." He stood up and lit another cigarette, blew out the first deep breath of it, and said to me, "You can't get to where you're going unless you've come the way you've gone." I had no idea what he meant.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, "But Joe, you're 10 years dead." "I never died," says he. "I never died," says he. "The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe," says I. "Takes more than guns to kill a man," says Joe. "I didn't die," says Joe. "I didn't die." And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, "What they forgot to kill went on to organize, went on to organize." San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where working men defend their rights, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, said.